Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm glad you're joining me here today. This is Karen Wyatt, and this is episode number 369. Today, I'm sharing with you an interview with Barbara Carnes, who is now going to become a regular guest on this show about every other month. Barbara and I are going to get together and talk about issues relevant to hospice and hospice care. Today, we're talking all about caregivers. And did you know that there are about 53 million caregivers taking care of adults in the United States right now? 1.6 million patients are receiving hospice care, but it's a huge number of people taking care of loved ones. And of that group, 21% report being in poor or fair health themselves. They're dealing with loneliness, financial strain, a lack of training, they're not paid, also just dealing with the burden of all the hours of care that are necessary to be alone with someone in the home. So Barbara's going to share a lot of tips and tools for caregivers that come from her new book, By Your Side, A Guide for Caring for the Dying at Home. And we'll get started with that interview in just a moment. I wanted to mention to you also, there's an event coming up on October 13th where Barbara and I will be presenting to the Death Doula Network of British Columbia. So on October 13th, it starts at 6:30 p.m. Pacific. We're going to be talking about how doulas can work with hospices, and specifically how death doulas might approach a hospice in order to talk about collaboration or working together. And there will be a link for that event in the show notes so you can check it out. So October 13th at 6:30 p.m., it's online. I hope you'll join us. I think it will be a great conversation. And also, I want to mention again that my course on death and dying class instructor training, so it's all about how to create a class or workshop or even a full semester course, just the nuts and bolts of how to put a class together. I'm not offering you the content because I'm assuming you know what it is you'd like to teach. You just need to know, how do I put this together? How do you structure the class? How do you market and promote the class? What to charge for it? How to attract the audience that's right for your class. So all of that kind of basic practical information of putting together a class in this training. It is online, 4 modules, self-paced, and the cost is $59. I'm trying to keep it affordable for anyone who might need this information. But if that price is out of reach for you, just send me an email and we can discuss how I might be able to give you a scholarship or a discount on that price if there is a financial hardship. So check out, again, the link for that will be also in the show notes, eolupodcast.com. This is episode 369. So you'll find links for my event with Barbara, for this course, and also a link if you're interested in supporting the podcast. eoluniversity.com/support is where you go. And today I'd like to thank my newest contributor on Patreon, Donna Fleming. Thank you, Donna, for signing up to be a member of the team. And don't forget, if you join our Patreon team, you get some special bonuses, like a monthly end-of-life news update that I curate for you. Also, some physical merchandise, either a sticker, a mini poster, or a mug. So thank you very much to everyone who's been keeping this podcast on the air for the last several years. I really appreciate you. And we'll move on now with my conversation with Barbara Carnes. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so happy to be welcoming back my very special guest, Barbara Carnes. And many of you probably know Barbara, and she's been on the podcast before, including just a couple of months ago when we talked about the basics of hospice care. And now Barbara and I are going to be doing a somewhat regular episode here every couple of months and talking more in depth about hospice care in the future, which I'm very excited to be launching that. So for anyone who's not familiar with Barbara's a hospice RN and internationally recognized author, speaker, thought leader, and expert on end-of-life care and the dynamics of dying. She wrote the little booklet called Gone From My Sight, The Dying Experience, which was published in 1985, I think that's right, and it's being used in hospices all over the world. She sold 30 million copies. It's called the Little Blue Hospice Book that many hospices, so many I've worked with, give this booklet out to all of their patients and families. And it's just a game changer for families to have it at the bedside and understand the changes that are happening at the end of life. But Barbara has a brand new book that I want to talk about today, that a guidebook for caregivers called By Your Side, A Guide for Caring for the Dying at Home. You can learn more about all of Barbara's work at her website, bkbooks.com. So Barbara, welcome back and thanks for joining me again.
Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, I look forward to our conversations anytime we're able to talk, because it ends up just being fruitful and rich. And I think we really provide people with a lot of information and education that everyone needs right now. And I thought today, in honor of your new book that just came out, A Guidebook for Caregivers, we should really dive into the caregiver perspective on end-of-life issues, because it's so important, and we don't very often talk about this. I think caregivers sometimes get short shrift, you know, even within hospice care itself. I think sometimes we forget that the caregiver is also someone who needs our help. So I'm excited to talk about that today. And I wanted to just kind of mention, statistically, there's so many family caregivers in our country, and I'm not sure people realize. I read one statistic said 53 million caregivers taking care of adults in the U.S. And I don't know if you've heard any different statistics than that, but and then about 1.6 million are caring for patients in hospice care. That's a lot of people, providing care.
It is, and it really, you know, my whole career has been focused on education at end of life. Really, it wasn't until last year when I became a caregiver for my husband. Now, he's well and he's fine, but there was a time frame where I was a primary caregiver and didn't know what the outcome really was going to be. With that, walking in those shoes, I thought, oh my gosh, this is hard work. And the caregiver tends to get lost in the shuffle of all the concern for the one that's ill. And the caregiver has not only everything on his or her shoulders as far as responsibility and the, you know, 24/7 work that they're doing, but they also have a life of their own, which tends to get shuffled off to the side. And it took me walking in those shoes to realize that I have something I can offer caregivers. And the key thing is you've got to take care of yourself as well as the person that you're taking care of.
And I think that message is one that gets overlooked and lost all the time, because I think somehow we walk into a home where there's a caregiver taking care of the patient, and we become a little bit blind to, what the caregiver is experiencing and going through. And I just, as you and I talked about, I'm a brand new grandmother, the grandmother of a 3-week-old, and I'm seeing what my son and daughter-in-law are experiencing as 24/7 caregivers of an infant. And I was thinking about, it's somewhat the same, this constant care for someone who needs you all the time. And it's a shock and it changes everything in your life. But caring for someone at the end of life, it's the opposite end of the spectrum, where this person is getting sicker and weaker every single day and needing more and more care every day. And so you're also experiencing grief and loss as you're caring for them.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the two ends of life spectrum, birth and death. And there's so many similarities, caregiving being a huge one. But what popped into my head is, with a new baby, you start off with fluids and milk, and then gradually you add soft foods. And, you know, it's a gradual process to reach solids. And with end of life, it's reversed, in that the hardcore foods are the first that we stop eating, and that progresses to softs, to liquids, to nothing. There's so many similarities. And caregivers don't necessarily know, because they haven't been told or have the picture shown to them. And so food for caregivers is a huge issue. In that, you know, if you don't eat, you don't live. And we've all got that down. And so we as caregivers are going to push food even when it's no longer necessary to do that. So I address a whole, I think, chapter on food, on nutrition and eating and not eating and what to do instead of.
It's so important, because I think this came up in a different interview, that for most of us, food is a form of love. You know, someone gives us food and shares food with us, and it's a way they show us that we're loved, and we hold on to that, and therefore we want to keep feeding our loved one. And it feels wrong somehow if we're not giving them the kind of food that we used to feed them, or if it feels like we're not giving them enough food. And yet it could actually be harmful to them if we push them to eat when that's not what their body wants or needs.
And we as caregivers will often take that not eating personally. You know, I fixed your favorite pie and you had one bite. You know, I went to all this trouble and you had one bite. And it's like a rejection of the love and care that we're trying to give, which is why end of life education is 90% of dealing and living through being with someone as end of life approaches, because it's different. It's totally different. And we don't know that.
Yeah, it's so true. And on the food issue alone, think of how much tension and stress could be saved if the caregiver in advance understood this is going to happen and it's natural and normal, and could just go with it, you know, and let the patient eat what they ask for. I remember when I was taking care of my mom, one thing she wanted was this custard that they served when she was in the hospital from the hospital cafeteria. I don't know why, because it sounds terrible to me, but that's what she was craving. So I ran to the hospital, went in the cafeteria and said, can you give me a container of the custard that you serve to patients? And they did. It was really sweet. So I could bring that home. But just an example of sometimes patients want unusual things that we may not expect or be prepared that that's what they feel like eating. But when they do, it's great to honor that.
Well, and I give some ideas on how the caregiver can work with food. Ideas like you're going to stop doing 3 meals a day, because a person's not going to eat 3 meals a day. You're going to give little snacks all through the day, and you're going to concentrate on high protein and high calories. And so little guidelines like that will make it hopefully take some of the pressure off of the caregiver. Knowledge opens up many doors, and the idea that if the caregiver knows what's happening is normal, mm-hmm. is natural. It's not a rejection of the caregiver when they don't eat the favorite pie. It's their body that just can't do it anymore.
So true. And so this issue of food, I think it's huge at the end of life. And I've seen so many caregivers struggle over it. But like we're saying, with just a little guidance, it could become so much simpler if the caregiver just has it spelled out a little bit, you know, this guide to this is what you can provide for your loved one, and save some of the stress around that, because there are also many other areas of stress too in trying to provide care.
One of the things that I learned and was very obvious for me was my memory, that all of the things that I had to remember to do, along with my normal, regular life that was occurring, and that we have to write everything down. If we don't write it down, you know, 15 minutes later, we can forget it. And so I created a simple one-sheet worksheet, which says, you know, did he pee today? Did he poop? What did he have for breakfast? So that when you go to the doctor or talk to the doctor, you save your individual sheets and it's all there. Or questions, what do I want to ask? You know, we must write everything down. So in that guidebook, I think an important part of it is the worksheet.
That's so important, because it's very true. You cannot remember exactly what happened even one day before, because there's constantly something new. You're constantly tending to a new crisis or a new situation, and it's very hard to remember the details. And some caregivers are doing some sort of medical care also. They're giving medications to the patient, or they might be changing the dressing on a wound or emptying a catheter. I mean, there could be all sorts of things they're doing that it would be helpful to just write down. When did I change that dressing? What time was it? So that later, when they can't remember, they have it written in front of them to help them.
Yeah, really important.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion, and something that I think would be really helpful for any caregiver in any situation. We're talking primarily about people caring for a loved one at the end of life in hospice, but for any caregiver, you know, the caregiving journey can be really long for some people. They care for loved ones for years before they reach the end of life, and any caregiver can benefit from knowing more about things like food and how to care for themselves better.
Right. And I, you know, one of the things that I think is for the caregiver is be tired, not getting enough sleep, because as I said, it's 24/7, you know, just because most people go to bed and sleep all night, generally that your sleep is going to be interrupted. Hopefully you can have a monitor so you can sleep in another room. But my kind of rule of thumb is you sleep when they sleep. And if that's at 10 o'clock in the morning, don't do the dishes, don't vacuum the floor, go lay down while she's asleep. You know, that is a really, I think, important factor, because we want, as a caregiver, to stay alert, to stay healthy, and that's getting your physical and emotional needs met as well, which is the other aspect. Emotionally, I think a caregiver needs a listener, needs a friend that they can call on the phone and say, oh my God, you wouldn't believe what just happened. And to be able to download, not that you're looking for answers. You want to make sure your listener isn't going to tell you what to do. You just want your listener to listen. And I think that's important in caregiving as well, is being able to download.
That's such a good reminder too. And I think one bit of advice I would have is don't try to be a caregiver alone. You have to have a village around you. You may not have other people who will spend the night and offer that care all night, but you need more people in your life who are engaged and involved and that you can turn to for help during this time.
Oh, vital. Absolutely vital. And yet, unfortunately, there are people out there that don't have a village to call on. And so when you don't have a village to call on, then you must figure out how to take care of yourself as well as the person that you're caring for.
And we mentioned this in our last conversation, but I just wanted to emphasize it again, that even when a family is engaged with hospice and hospice provides some wonderful help, you can only do home hospice if you have a caregiver at home to care for the patient, and the burden of the care falls on that patient. Hospice helps and assists, but I think it's good to remind people there are a lot of limitations in what the hospice staff can offer.
And the same with end-of-life doulas. You know, they're support, but the operative word is support. They're not providing the care, and that is the person in the home that's there 24/7 providing all the care.
Yeah, they're not there at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're trying to figure out what to do and how to handle a situation. And when you mentioned sleep before, it's so important, because if you're sleep deprived, it's that much harder to make decisions and to even figure out what your next step should be and be creative and solve problems. I think it all fits together. Your stress goes up even higher when you're in that kind of state of drowsiness from not getting enough sleep, and then not able to make the best choices in the moment.
Well, and also when you're tired, your patients, and I mean patients with a CE, not a T, are shortened. And so you won't be as flexible necessarily in your thinking, in your ability to interact. Just to be direct, you can be irritable, more irritable. If we're not getting enough sleep, then it will come out in irritability and impatience.
Yeah. And I think one thing I've seen, I mean, it's even in the name caregiver, is that there's an emphasis on what you're giving to the patient. And it definitely, I think, our image of what a caregiver does and how a caregiver operates, it sets up this expectation that you should always be ready and willing to give whatever the patient needs, but that's not realistic.
It's not, because you'll run out of steam. You will burn out literally and not be able to provide care. So we as caregivers often think, I'm being selfish because I'm thinking of myself, when my special person has all of these physical problems and life is so difficult for my special person. Why am I thinking about myself? There's that element in there, and I just want to wipe that off, because there's no place for that. It's not being there. You are giving of yourself, and in order to give of yourself, you must take care of yourself.
That's so true. And I noticed that there is a big section in your new book on taking care of yourself, because you honestly you can't be your best as a caregiver if you haven't cared for yourself. And I was thinking, I know sometimes I think patients may send out the message that I need just you to be my caregiver. And I think caregivers need to learn how to set boundaries with the patient and let the so the patient has reasonable expectations too of what's possible.
Such a good point, because when someone's really ill, we tend to treat them like a spoiled child. And I say that with love in my heart, but we tend to give in to their often irrational or selfish, because a person, when they have an illness, become very self-centered. They're very concerned about their body and they're not looking out at other people. And so as a caregiver, we have to recognize that it's okay and important to set limits. We don't have to treat the patient like a spoiled child and let them have everything that they want. We can, with love in our heart, say, you know, that bad, that's just not going to work. I'm not going to be able to do that for you. Or whatever it is that is the boundary you need to set.
Oh, I love that. I love that example. And it just reminded me when I was taking care of my mom, as she got more confused, she kept trying to climb out of bed and she was too weak to stand on her own. And what I finally said to her that actually worked, I said, I want to be here taking care of you, but you have to help me take care of you. And if you can't stay in bed, I won't be able to lift you up to get you back in bed. And I won't be able to keep taking care of you here. We'll have to make other arrangements and I need you to help me by staying in bed. And that clicked with her. She understood that. She never tried to climb out of bed again when I said that to her, which was really validating that it actually is okay to set a boundary. And maybe the patient will be happy to hear the boundary because it never occurred to them. They didn't realize it.
Yeah. You know, I remember going into a home and the patient, hospice nurse, and he was a cantankerous character, and he's waving this cane at me as he's yelling at me. And what's going through my mind is, what am I going to do here? You know? And so I said, Joe, put the cane down. And if you pick it up and wave it at me one more time, I'm out the door. That is unacceptable. We have to be able to set limits. And as a caregiver, we often feel very uncomfortable setting limits.
It's so true. We just believe somehow we should be able to do anything and everything. And I don't know where that notion comes from. I don't know if we get ideas from movies and television that we're supposed to be superheroes somehow at the end of life, but it just isn't true and it isn't realistic.
You know, we tend to focus so much on the patient. And yes, I understand that, but if we don't put some energy and focus on the caregiver, we won't have a caregiver. And then, as you pointed out to your mother, the alternative to that is then you're going to have to go someplace. And none of us want to do that.
Yeah.
With some people, that rational thinking will work. For others, it may not. And it is not a failure of being a caregiver if you can't do it. If you reach a point where you say, I just can't do this anymore. And then you need to look for alternatives. And that may be placement in a home if you can't find someone else to come in. And yet so many caregivers keep pushing and pushing and pushing beyond their limit. And what I'm saying is, you have permission to say, I can't do this anymore.
So true. And it may be that your relationship with your loved one is so much better if you do make other arrangements and you can come and visit and you can sit with them and be a support person instead of being the full-time caregiver.
Yeah, absolutely. We think of caregiver as in my home and I will take care of mom. But sometimes that doesn't work. That dream has to be altered. And that's okay. Hard. It's hard, but it is okay. And oftentimes necessary for everyone's well-being.
Yeah. And if you think about a patient in an inpatient hospice or in a residential facility, think about all the staff people that are involved in providing care to that patient. And the one home family caregiver is trying to play all the roles of all those staff members alone at home.
And taking care of someone at end of life is hard work, not only physically hard work, but it's emotionally hard because we recognize that mom's dying. Mom's not going to be here. And add to that, that we don't have any role models on what dying is like. We think it's going to be like the movies or television, and it's not. So when mom's doing as she approaches death, what we don't understand or know is going to happen, then we think something pathological is happening. And then we're really scared. That's why part of the book is about signs of approaching death and what to do when someone is months, weeks, days, and hours from death, because most of us don't know what's going to happen. And so we carry apprehension and fear with us all the time. A lot of it is, well, he looks like he doesn't feel good today. I wonder if he's going to die today. Because we don't know there's a process, mm-hmm. and what to look for. And so I try really hard to neutralize the fear that most caregivers, particularly knowing that end of life is going to happen, that they carry with them.
And that's a very helpful section in the book, along with, well, so much, you put so much important information in this guidebook, and you did it so succinctly in a way. So it's not some massive tome for people to try to read. It's a spiral bound guidebook that's easy to get through and to find what you need and look up information in the book that will help you right now in the moment.
Well, and that's it. No one has the energy to read volumes. And so I think I'm going to go with 80. Maybe there's 80 pages, and some of those are the daily care plan. So it's large print, which all my work is, and simple, direct, but I try to have it gentle as well. But you're so right. No one's going to sit down and read volumes, but they can get through a chapter at a time, or 80 pages, with pictures even.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And you included some of the decision making, which again, might be a part of caregiving that people forget about, that they have to make decisions about advanced directives, financial decisions for the patient, funeral planning. There are so many other things to think about, and it typically all falls on the caregiver to make these decisions. So I like that you opened the book with that whole discussion. Again, it's a great reference for someone to just look up, well, what do I need to know about this and how do I take care of this?
Yeah, I tried to address a lot of the things that people don't think about or don't know about when it comes to end of life. You know, we hear all the time about having a living will, having advanced directives, but really in our mind, other people die. You know, I'm not going to need it, neither is anyone close to me. And so oftentimes by the time we do need one, it's too late. And so by addressing this advanced directives and funeral plans, I'm trying to give the caregiver some guidance so that if they've got this early enough, they can get this done, get the advanced directive, get the DNR if they need it.
And also, if it's early enough, they might be able to discuss it with their loved one and ask them their preferences. If they wait too long, that may not be possible. They will be making all the decisions alone. But if they can do it early enough, which might be one reason why getting your book earlier rather than later is a really good idea, as even just a reference, if you think about it, I mean, within our families, someone in our family is likely to end up being a caregiver at some time of life in the future. But it's likely to happen for someone in our family. Could be our children, could be us. We don't know for sure.
Absolutely. And the thing is, there are really just two ways to die. If you think about it, it's fast death or it's gradual death. And a gradual death occurs when someone has an illness that the doctors can't fix, or it's just old age. You know, the elderly are slowly dying every day. And the elderly will have a caregiver, maybe because they can't completely take care of themselves. Well, that is the time to get the advanced directives, to get the durable medical power of attorney. So get it in place. It doesn't mean you're going to need it tomorrow, but get it in place. I think all elderly need, everyone needs to have an advanced directive, but particularly elderly, and we tend to don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, then we end up with situations where someone who's really in the early stages of dying, in the dying process, ends up getting a feeding tube put in or some invasive, aggressive treatment that is not going to help. It's only going to prolong the process and add to their suffering, and that's just because no one thought about it or talked about it in advance.
Yes. As you were talking, I thought of that. I really want to stress for the caregiver to, as you said earlier, it takes a village. You can't do this alone. Reach out to, if you're involved in a church. Oftentimes, churches have Stephen ministries, they have parish nurses. Get some support through them. If the doctors have said, I can't fix you, and you have an illness, and death is going to be the outcome, then don't wait to get on hospice. You know, call in hospice so that you've got some guidance and support. Get to know your neighbors. Let your kids help you. You know, work out plans with them. Okay, on Thursdays, you, my daughter, come over and stay so that I can just go to the grocery store or maybe go to the park and sit on a bench. Or maybe go to a movie, you know, work out how you can bring others in to help you.
Exactly. And well, it's another plug for your book, but I would say if you if early on you become a caregiver for your loved one, they're not in the active dying phase or anything yet, but that's a good time to have a book like your guidelines to begin reading things and just to go through the book, find out what's of interest right now or what helps you right now. But it also lets you, you're familiar with what information is available here, because there may be that time at 2 o'clock in the morning when you need extra help and you'll be familiar with the book and know, oh, there's something about this. I can go look this up. I can get the help that I need. So I think it's so great to have a resource like this on hand.
Well, and what we don't know is that taking care of someone at end of life, and the elderly are at end of life also, whether they have an active disease or not. Taking care of someone at end of life is different than taking care of someone who's going to get better. But most people don't know that. And so this guidebook teaches you the difference in the care for the elderly and for end of life. A big difference.
Definitely.
Don't know about.
Yeah, you're so right. And I know you have a chapter on caring for dementia patients at the end of life, which adds additional factors. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that and why that type of care is also difficult.
Well, the thing is with dementia doesn't play by the rules. You know, there are signs of approaching death that I can ask a few questions and I can pretty well tell if a person has months, weeks, days, or hours based on food intake, on sleeping, and on withdrawal. I don't even have to know a diagnosis. None of us do. Ask these three questions. But with dementia, it doesn't work because a person can sleep all the time and not have entered the dying process. A person with dementia can be totally withdrawn from this world for years and not have entered the dying process. It isn't until food becomes an issue, when they're holding food in their mouth or they're choking, they're not swallowing. If they don't know how to get that food from their mouth into their belly, then that's the time that the dying process for someone who has dementia will begin. And then you're looking, depending upon body weight, how much storage that person has in their body will depend upon if it's weeks or days before death occurs. That's your only guideline with dementia. Now, it used to be that it was suggested that a person have a feeding tube, but even the Alzheimer's Association has come out and said, we do not recommend feeding tubes for that stage of dementia.
Oh, thank goodness, because it almost seems cruel in a way to prolong that stage.
Absolutely. It is cruel. Not only are you lengthening something that is unavoidable, but you are adding discomfort and even more confusion to this person's life. Because they're not going to understand why they have tubes coming out of their belly and the discomfort that brings. In my mind, that's do I say it? Torture. It's just cruel to do that at that point.
And that's likely to just increase combativeness on the part of the patient, which adds even more to the caregiver's stress. And it's all unnecessary.
Yeah. Now, I'm not saying one day you just stop feeding. I believe you always offer, but you don't force. You don't force food.
Yeah. I think that's a really good rule of thumb. Let the food be there. If if the person is able and willing to eat it, that's great. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good reminder. And anyone who is trying to be a caregiver for a dementia patient, those caregivers need so much support. And if you know anyone who's in that situation, we all need to be stepping up and offering them help and support, because it can go on for a long time. That caregiving situation can last for years.
Well, and that's it. And you mentioned earlier grief. From the moment of diagnosis, we begin grieving the loss of our loved one. And with dementia, it's even harder because we've lost them even when we can see them and interact with them. And so we're grieving every single day, not just the eventual loss, but the daily losses. And it's really, really challenging. It's really sad and hard.
I think that we do need to acknowledge more the grief that any caregiver might be feeling, anticipatory grief, but also just grief for all the losses that happen every day. There's one after another. And that's in contrast, like, to having a new baby at home, where there's some new delight or new joy every day, like something the baby learns things and gets stronger and grows every day. And there's constantly something positive. This is exactly the opposite of every day seeing something be lost and having to feel the grief of that. So I think we need to do a better job of acknowledging those emotions, grief, and then also guilt, because I think every caregiver I've ever known has felt guilty in some way or another for not doing a perfect job taking care of their loved one.
And it can't be perfect, because none of us are perfect. And yet we as caregivers set our expectations very, very high. And so we need that listener. We need support. We need the village in order to come out of this hole.
And I love your idea of the listener, because there might be people in the audience who themselves are not caregivers right now, but could you be a listener? Could you be a support person for someone who is a caregiver and let them know, just call me if you need someone to talk to? Because I just can't imagine how helpful it might be just to talk on the phone for 15 minutes with someone who has empathy for your situation. That could be a huge relief.
Well, and also you said to say, call me, and yet most caregivers won't call. You know, as a friend, I can say, oh, call me if you need anything. But as a caregiver, for some reason, most of us won't do that. And so as the listener, as the support person, you can say, you know, I'm going to call you tomorrow around this time. Just going to check in. We don't have to talk a lot, but I'm just going to check in and see how you're doing. It's up to the listener and the support people to make some of those moves. And if the caregiver really doesn't want you, then they're going to say, you know, don't call, I'm okay. Or they're not going to answer the phone, or, you know, but we can't expect them to reach out to us if they need something, because that's kind of the nature of a caregiver. It's, mm-hmm. I can do this. I can handle it.
That's such a good point. I'm glad that you mentioned that. It's so true, because it is in the nature of a caregiver to think, I can do it and I should do it all, but also to not want to be a burden to anyone else. And so the idea in their minds is, I can't call that person because all this stress I'm feeling might be too much for them, and I don't want to lay that on them, so I won't call. And you're right. It should be, if we're trying to be support people, we should be the ones who are willing to pick up the phone and call, or stop by, or whatever it might take.
Ring the front door doorbell and say, I drove by McDonald's and I've got us a Big Mac and some fries. If you've got a minute, I could come in. But if you're not, if you're busy, then here's a little gift. Enjoy your lunch. You know, little thoughtful things like that. Someone who's involved in church, to have the members in the congregation contact and say, I would come over if you'd like and stay with your dad while you go to church. Giving an opportunity. But it's up to us, the support people, to be creative and not expect the caregiver to say what their needs are, because they don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember when I was caring for my mom, her sister lives just a couple of doors down from my mom's house. She came over one day and said, here's the key to my house. I'll stay with your mom. Take a change of clothes and go take a shower at my house and just relax for a while. I'm here with your mom. And it was amazing and wonderful. And I couldn't have taken a shower at my mom's house and felt nearly the amount of relief that I felt just getting out of the house and going somewhere else and being free of worrying about her for a short while. So it's amazing what a difference it can make. Just that little bit of thoughtfulness.
Yeah. Being a supportive friend.
Yeah. Yeah. And we all need this. We all need to remember our friends and be thinking about what situations they're in and reaching out to help them. And again, as a friend, like, your book is a great gift to give to someone that you know who's going into a caregiving situation.
I had someone just this week, a friend of mine, called me and said that one of her relatives has a life-threatening illness. And she said, I want to give this book to her caregiver, the wife. And then she said, and I think I probably ought to have one for me. I'm 80 years old. I guess I better read it. And then she ordered 3 books, that one she was going to keep and give away to people that she felt needed it. So it's a guide. Like we said, it's not that long. It's simple, and yet really important information.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful not just for the caregiver in the home, but for other family members to be able to read it, because they need some of this information as well. If they come to visit, they need to understand what's happening and what to look for. And it will answer a lot of the questions that probably come up to their minds, like, why aren't you feeding mom dinner right now? You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it will also hopefully spark the idea of, well, you know, my sister's the caregiver, but I can do, I can be the support person. I can help her as well as dad.
Yeah. And Barbara, I know in the book you also address pain management, because I think that's another big area where people have questions sometimes. Family members are nervous about giving pain medications to their loved ones and fearful that they'll give too much, and I think that ends up being a big responsibility for family members, but they need training. They need to understand what it is they're doing. So talk a little bit about what you advise there.
Well, just like everything else, pain management at end of life is different than pain management for someone who's going to get better. And most people think about addiction and overdose when they think of narcotics. And what I try to get across is that dying is not painful. Disease causes pain. And if a person's disease history is one of pain, then we will treat that pain until the person's last breath, because that pain won't go away. It will change, because as the body shuts down, it's not going to process the pain medicine in the same way. So you might actually have to take more as death approaches. But there's a lot of people that die from diseases that don't have pain. And if pain is not an issue, then you're not going to give a narcotic. The person's body that's dying and that pain has not been a part of their disease history, their body will feel heavy. It'll feel tired. It'll have an ache all over feeling to it, like if you have the flu, and I don't mean COVID, I just mean the flu, that ache all over. Well, you wouldn't take a narcotic if you had the flu. You'd take a couple of ibuprofen. And so if you think a person in the days to hours or even weeks before death is restless and uncomfortable, give them a couple of ibuprofen and see if that makes a difference. Yes, some people that don't have pain in their disease process can develop pain as death approaches. Most won't and most don't. So you try, if pain isn't an issue, try the ibuprofen. If you still think, he's just really looks uncomfortable, then maybe you want a Haldol or an Ativan to kind of relax them. There's a lot of things you can do that don't involve narcotics.
That's a really good point. And I wanted to emphasize too that the hospice nurse and physician are well-trained in symptom management, and that's the best way to utilize them is keep track of any symptoms, as you said, on your tracker that the patient is having, and ask them to help figure out what does your loved one need. Do they need something for pain, or do they need other medications? Also, allow them to teach you how to give the medication in the most effective way so you can feel more comfortable providing it to people and not afraid that you're doing something wrong if you give the medication to your loved one.
And with medications as end of life approaches, there will be a point where the person won't be able to swallow the pills. And depending upon what the medication is, sometimes you can get that medication in liquid and put a little bit under their tongue. When I was running a hospice, I had a contract with a pharmacy that took our medications and made them into cream. And we would rub that medication on their skin. Now, the nurse or whoever or the caretaker has to wear gloves so that they don't get it. And also anything you take by mouth, you can put in the rectum. And so there isn't really a need in end of life pain management for needles, for IVs, for shots in the rear. You know, we just don't need those.
Exactly. And sometimes those alternative methods of giving the medication are so effective. They work so quickly. It's really amazing, but it's important for caregivers to be told and taught the many different ways a medication could be given to their loved one.
Because it goes back to taking care of someone at end of life is different. All the rules, everything we play by is different in end-of-life care.
Yeah, so very true. And none of us are prepared for it. It doesn't come naturally to any of us. We all need guidance and training. So, Barbara, I wanted to remind listeners about your new book. It just barely came on sale, right? Came out. By Your Side, A Guide for Caring for the Dying at Home. And go to Barbara's website, bkbooks.com, and they can just order it from there. You can get a single copy or you can order in bulk also.
Either or, yes. You can do it all from the website. Put in your credit card. The whole works right there on the website.
And while you're there, I mean, people should also take a look at all the many booklets that you've written as well for the bedside.
Well, and you know, I write weekly blog articles that when you're at the website, sign up for the blog articles. They're educational, they're short, they aren't very long. Put in your name and your email address, and once a week you'll get an email with the blog attached. It's a gift that I give anyone who wants it. And then you can go to the website under the blog section and put in any word. You could put in pain, you could put in dementia, and all the blogs that are related to whatever you put in are going to come forward. And it's an education field that you can explore.
That's fantastic. That's a great resource for people to have. And listen to End of Life University podcast, because Barbara will be here every other month with me, and we'll be talking about some other topic related to hospice care at the end of life. So thank you once again, Barbara. It's always wonderful to talk with you.
Hey, see you in a couple months.
Yeah, we'll put our thinking caps on and come up with our next topic. Take care.
Okay, bye.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Barbara Carnes, as I always do. And I hope you're excited, as I am, that Barbara's going to be coming back every other month to join me in conversation again. And we'll be talking about all aspects of hospice care. Also, don't forget the Death Doula Network of British Columbia, the online event taking place October 13th. From 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Pacific time. And Barbara and I will be presenting there and talking about how death doulas can interface with hospice, among other things. So you'll find the Eventbrite link for that in the show notes for this episode, eolupodcast.com, episode 369. And sign up if you'd like to join us on October 13th. I'd love to see you there. So remember, if you enjoy this content, please share it with other people and encourage them to subscribe wherever they happen to listen. You can also leave a rating and review wherever you're listening. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. That's End of Life University on YouTube. All of those will help me a great deal. Thanks once again to everyone who has chosen to support the podcast with a small financial donation. And you can go to eoluniversity.com/support and find out how you can help out. So until we are together again next week for another interview, remember that we're here for love. That is our ultimate purpose here, just to learn how to love. So face your fear. Be ready for whatever life brings your way, and love each and every moment of your precious life. Bye-bye.